So, welcome to the second in the series. We're going to be talking about, of course, the poem, the song of the grass roof hermitage. But I thought today, before we begin, I'd like to ask you to do two things. First of all, I'd like you to write down maybe three situations where you get stuck. And by getting stuck, I mean things like, somebody criticizes you and you get defensive. You kind of get stuck in that defensive role. Or you're late and immediately fall into a kind of panic. Or somebody makes a suggestion that goes against yours and you immediately feel criticized and want to attack. Or anger arises in a certain situation for you. Or jealousy, or envy, or any kind of, kind of unpleasant situation. Some kind of unwholesome situation you've noticed arises in that particular situation. Does that make sense?
So another word, like when we get hooked.
When we get hooked. Snag. When we get, and I use the word stuck because that's what comes in the poem, but when you get hooked, that's a really good, another good way to express it. So just three. Situations, maybe hope you can come up with three that may happen. Okay. So now what would be a wholesome way to respond to each of those situations? So I see some people writing, and that's fine. Just finish up what you wanted to write. But for the rest of us, just as we did last week, I'd like to start off by everyone together. We'll just recite this poem out loud. And the people, when you finished writing what you want to, just come in and join us when you're ready. So, Song of the Grassroot Hermitage. I built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. A great vehicle, Bodhisattva, trusts without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present. Not dwelling south or north, east or west. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines. Jade palaces over million towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers, be familiar with their instruction. Bind grasses to build a hut, and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from the skin bag here and now. Oh, thank you. We seem to have lost the, or at least almost lost that tradition of reading out loud. Especially poetry. So much poetry, I think we read silently, but we should revive it. You know, we should read poems out loud to each other. Some people do. I think a really wonderful practice. Last week, we talked a little bit about Sherdo, the person who wrote this poem. We talked a little bit about his life and the two works that still remain today with us. And then I think we got as far as the first line of this poem. It is, I was thinking, really impossible to know what message Sherdo thought and believed he was really including in this poem to us. It's clearly a teaching poem, which was a very common practice, both in the practice done by the Buddhists and also by the Taoists. And this is how they left their teachings for the next generation and the next generation, particularly the Chinese. And really throughout Chinese history, including today, poetry has an importance that I think has really waned in the West. Chinese poetry deals with most of the themes and topics that are pretty common in contemporary Western poetry. But it also, throughout its history and today, has a strong teaching role, as this poem is a good example of, but also a very strong political role. It's not uncommon for poets in modern China today to be jailed and beaten because they wrote a poem protesting the actions or policies of the communist government. Even Nobel Peace or Nobel laureates are not exempt from this in China. So let's go back though to the poem here. The hut that Sherdo built was a grass thatch hut, not one of stone or brick. And so it was like the snow huts that my brother and I built in our childhood that I mentioned last week. Just like that, Sherdo's hut will need repair or rebuilding before long. It doesn't allow for even the delusion of permanence. The traditional image that's used in Chinese Buddhist texts for the myriad things or for the all the phenomena of the world, of the universe, is grass. Grasses are graminoids, to use the botanical term. And that includes things, you know, what we call true grasses, as well as sedges and rushes, cereals, bamboos, lawns, most of the plants, of course, found in grasslands and prairies. All of these are grasses. So the image of grass as representing all phenomena strikes me as really beautiful and quite appropriate and very poetic. When I was a boy growing up in Alberta, I remember walking out into the large grain fields where all you could see were the tall grasses, the tall grains waving in the winds. A kind of endless sea of ripe grain against the blue sky. In earlier times, before Chinese Buddhism in India, the Buddhist tradition talked about phenomena, and particularly what makes up a person, what makes up the individual, as the five skandhas, or the five aggregates, or heaps, as they're sometimes called in English. And the skandhas, just very roughly, may be thought of all the different components that come together to make up, in this case, let's talk about an individual, a person, all the pieces that come together to make up a person. And that means form or matter, sensation, feeling or perception, discrimination, mental volitions, consciousness, And these are topics that we've talked about before here in the Zendo, and I'm not going to go into details about what all that means right here. But just to know that the Buddha kind of, I think, created this schema to show that what we think of as I, me, or mine is something that arises, changes constantly, and disappears moment by moment. And there's no enduring, permanent self. And in this Mahayana tradition, of which Zen is a part of, freedom, our kind of ultimate freedom, lies in deeply realizing and penetrating that nature of the skandhas or aggregates as basically empty, basically not having any kind of independent existence. But the Chinese were more poets than logicians, like the early Indians were. So they use the word grasses, something that grows and decays, and then grows again and decays, as representing everything. Everything grows, changes constantly, disappears, new things arise. So I think Sherdo, when he used grass, really wanted us to experience that. Sherdo's hut is a physical place, but it is also, I think, his life, a metaphor for his life. Sherdo constructed his life, like we all do, with the bits and pieces of this great world, with his experiences, his feelings, his thoughts. Our life is transient, changes, just like a grass hut. And our life is irreplaceable because its beauty is absolutely unique. No two grass huts are the same. No two lives are the same either. Having lived in Japan, I developed a particular appreciation for Japanese aesthetics. And the heart, I think, of Japanese aesthetics, Japanese beauty, is the kind of poignant feeling that arises because of impermanence. Because of impermanence. Because of that, we have to appreciate and take notice now. This moment, this place, where everything is in constant change. This hut where Sherdo's life unfolds is something that will undergo, of course, constant change. He tells us, also in the first line, there's nothing of value. Telling us, perhaps, there is nothing that he is attached to. Yet, he is clearly at ease. Because the next line goes, after eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. Now this is quite different from the usual Zen tone or admonitions, because Zen often says, you know, one of the famous lines is, practice as if your head was on fire. But Sherdo models for us a life that's not overly complicated, that's not fraught. Well, he clearly sees that his hut is one of grass, right? And recognizes and embraces, I think, the transitory nature of everything. Sherdo also recognizes and knows what's needed from moment to moment. When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. Wouldn't it be nice to have a life like that? Just, now it's time for this. Now it's time for this. As I mentioned in my talk last week, I lived in Japan for a number of years, and when I was first there, I practiced Aikido with a teacher living with him, Mr. Hayakawa. And one of Mr. Hayakawa's frequent criticisms of my Aikido practice was, and I'll quote, "Maiko-san, you think too much." And alas, this is true today as well. Caught in worries about the future, my past, or worrying about going over my past hurts, or wishing for something different than this present moment, my life is diminished. I am diminished. And in my distraction, I hurt others. In this poem, Sherdo is not asking us to become a hermit. He's asking us to turn toward our life as it is. If we are not present for our life now, when will we be? What is our experience when we are really present? Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who originally brought this form of Zen Buddhism to Japan, he wrote, "The Zazen, or the meditation that I speak of, is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of enjoyment and ease." Is that what you felt? First two periods? Enjoyment and ease? When I first read these lines, I didn't understand what he meant. Doing my first long retreats in Japan did not bring ease and joy. They brought painful knees and back. They brought exhaustion. But later, I came to see that my suffering, my dukkha, was really much more my turning away, my effort to distract myself, and my wanting the situation to be different than it really was. That was my suffering. Does that make sense? Pain and suffering in the Buddhist tradition are not the same. Pain is the physical discomfort, the physical sensation. Suffering is, ouch, oh my God, I want this different, let me out of here, is this ever going to stop? I'm never going to walk again. But you probably haven't experienced that. When present, when we're really present, we are aware with a natural ease, and I think we are mindful of how to take care of this life. There is a time to sit, a time to sit in zazen, to meditate. There's a time to take a nap, a time to munch on chocolate. At first glance, this line in the poem may not seem that important, but we should not be deceived. When Sherdo tells us there is nothing of value, perhaps he's telling us that he is not blown about by the eight worldly winds. And those winds are praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, pain and pleasure. Not blown about by the worldly winds, he is alive and present and acts accordingly. So the poem goes on. "When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds." In the Zen tradition, weeds are a metaphor for delusions and obstacles. For when we get wrapped up in our thoughts or stuck in habitual ways of acting, that's kind of what it refers to, that's what weeds are. Wrapped up in our thoughts, stuck in habitual ways of acting. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. You know, isn't life just like this? We finish a long retreat. We've done a challenging and helpful workshop on improving ourselves. We've read a great book on how to be perfect. We've resolved our New Year's resolution to drop the old patterns. We've just made up with our partner or friend or some perceived slight when wham, something even rather trivial pushes the old button once more. And we're back in a tight, dark place. Weeds appear all the time. But we don't often clearly see the weeds. We just react to them. Maybe when Sherdo was young, he practiced as if his hair was on fire, creating this wonderful, spare, and simple life. A mind clear of the habitual, constant evaluation. And so he knows what's needed from moment to moment. Yet, soon as the hut is completed, after the training is finished, the meditation period ends, the book is read, weeds appear. And we may find that what we have tried so long to let go of, tried so hard to vanish, appears anew. The poem by Hafiz that I have shared here before in an earlier Dharma talk, I think really sums this up well. So if you'll indulge me, I'll read it one more time. So this is by the Persian poet. I think he lived in the 1300s. It is always a danger to the aspirants on the path when they begin to believe and act as if the 10,000 idiots who so long ruled and lived inside have all packed up their bags and skipped town or died. But wait a minute, it gets worse. Sherdo says, when it was completed, fresh weeds appeared, and now it has been lived in covered by weeds. So what are we to make of this when one of the great famous Zen ancestors boldly states that his hut, his life, is full of weeds? What hope is there for us who don't practice full-time, who don't live in a monastery, who are not hermits tucked away in some mountain recess? Sherdo is demonstrating for us a way of looking at life that goes against our common way. The Buddha's first noble truth was highlighting the dissatisfaction or the dukkha that arises in our life, that is kind of ever-present. Weeds are dukkha. But as any gardener knows, pulling up weeds is a never-ending task. Sherdo does not pull up his weeds. He sees them clearly. And in this clear seeing, the person in the hut lives calmly. Obstacles and difficulties are not overcome. They are seen for what they are, parts of this life. Just as the Buddha did not overcome sickness, he did not overcome old age and death. Sherdo does not overcome the many weeds of his life, nor is he overcome by them. And that's the difference. He lives calmly. We don't need to fix ourselves. We don't need to engage in that endless pursuit of self-improvement with the shimmering goal in the distance of a beautiful life. Zen, this practice, is not about improving. It's about releasing. There's the famous passage, again by Dogen, in a piece he wrote called the Genjo Koan that expresses this really well. And you've probably have heard it before. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. Through practice, we drop or forget the self and discover an intimacy with the world. And with this intimacy, we live calmly, appreciating even weeds. Dandelions are beautiful, and they are endless. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Worldly places people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. The calm abiding in the midst of weeds is because the person in the hut is not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. There's a natural freedom and a spaciousness that arises when we don't cling to a view. I think we've all tormented ourselves at some point in our lives about how we should be, how others should be, or how the world should be. It's not that views or opinions are bad or that they should be avoided, but when we're stuck to them, we become limited. Holding too close or too strongly to anything makes it a kind of obstacle. And Zen literature is filled with those cautionary tales in this regard. I'll just give you one. In China, there was a master, Tangka. And one day, when he was very cold, he found himself in a temple where the head priest was very strict and traditional. Tangka was a rather unconventional Zen monk. Being cold, and the other monks around him shivering, he took the wooden statue of Buddha in the main Buddha hall and burned it. And when the head of the temple got wind of this, he was extremely angry, and he said, "Why have you burned this statue?" And Tangka replied, "I wanted to get the sariya of the Buddha after it burnt." And in India and Japan and in China, they traditionally burn the body. And the sariya, that's a Sanskrit term, are the kind of relics that are left after the body is burned. The head of the temple, when he heard this, got really angry, and he said, "You stupid idiot, it's not possible to get sariya from the statue of a Buddha. It's just made of wood." And hearing this, Tangka said, "Oh, then let's burn the other two statues and keep warm." It is said that Tangka did not have bad karma by doing this, but the eyelashes of the head priest fell out. Not stuck is like our Zen practice, our Zazen practice. We sit in Zazen with our eyes slightly open, looking downward in a soft gaze, and the events inside, our thoughts, our states of mind, our emotions, interact with the outside, with the information from our senses, hearing the sounds, air conditioner, cars going by, people coughing. Inside and outside, kind of moving back and forth, and to the point it can be difficult to separate one from the other. Not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. And yet I'm sure we've all experienced the annoyance when we hear a particular grating sound or people talking when we really want silence to enjoy our meditation. One of the first retreats I did at a center in just outside Portland, Oregon, there was a woman sitting beside me who I think probably was getting over a cold or had allergies. And throughout the whole retreat, she would do that over and over and over again. I was stuck. But how do we recognize when we are stuck? And how do we let go? Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. Of course, Sherdo is a monk in ancient China. He's not going to live in a condo. But this connects back to his first line, the first line of the poem, where there is nothing of value. Last week, I suggested a question for us to consider was, what is of true value? What is important? What really is important? So another take on this, I think, would be, where do you live? Or maybe more to the point, where are you alive? Where are you alive? At what time? At what place? Doing what activity? Where are you alive? Sherdo doesn't tell us what is of value for him, or where he is alive, or what he loves. But he does say it is not what society tells him. It's not where the average or the worldly person lives, not what the average person loves. Sherdo, unlike today, wasn't swamped with advertising and messages. But even in the Tang China, where he when he lived, there was a strong social pressure to study hard as a student, to pass the civil service entrance exams, to get a good, high-paying and prestigious jobs with the government, and to continue on the family line, to get married and have kids. These were strong social pressures. So another question for us, perhaps to ponder, is where do I live? Where am I most alive? What do I love? Just before I started to give my talk, I asked you to consider where you get stuck and what may be a more wholesome way than habitual way how you habitually deal with that kind of stuckness. I want to come back to that. And to have us consider one technique that's been used in the Buddhist tradition for hundreds of years, and that is the use of gathas. These are kind of very short poems that are meant to help us reflect and remember when we get stuck and how we really want to be when we get stuck. Or at least this is one way of using them. So I've given you some examples here to look at. And because we're still okay for time for a few minutes, I'd like us to read these. And I'll ask for some volunteers to read them. And just to get a flavor of how it works. And then the homework assignment will be for you to take one or two or all three of these that you obstacles, difficult situations that you've considered, and to come up with your own gatha as a response to how you would like to really deal with the particular situation that's arisen for you. So I'll pause this here.